and most important is the work of the many people connected with the Institute. Tonight, I would like to mention three individuals who have been more than helpful, who have in fact been essential, without whose participation the Institute would not be functioning at anything like the level of quality and performance that it does. First is our Vice President, Mr. Justice Bill Traynor, who has chaired several meetings and will chair more before the end of the year. Second is Dr. Peter Jones of the Alumni Association, who is our Honorary Secretary and who handles, with his staff, many of the administrative details of the Institute's operation. Third, and of special significance and importance, is Mrs. Belna Metz, our program chairman, who has devoted countless hours this year and in other years to making each year of the Institute the best year ever. And as president of the Institute, therefore, I simply wish to take this opportunity to remind you of the importance of the volunteer contributions that these three individuals have made. Your assistance, however, is also needed. Volunteers can do many things, but only money can pay our bills. And by sheer accident, the first publication listed on the CV of tonight's speaker is a book titled Financing International Organization, the United Nations Budget Process. You will not believe my good luck when I looked at his CV to find something to trigger off my regular Saturday night appeal, but there it was. The Vancouver Institute budget process does not deal with the large dollar figures that the United Nations does. However, like the UN, it constantly hovers on the edge of insolvency. And you, therefore, can contribute to our solvency by joining the Institute. Our membership rates are far from demanding. $2 student, $10 single, $15 for a family. If you join tonight, you will be placed on our mailing list until next fall. Memberships will be available in the hall after the meeting, and for those of you who have not yet succumbed to my numerous appeals, I ask you once more to please join. Our speaker tonight, Professor David Singer, is a professor of political science at the University of Michigan. He has received numerous honors since he received his PhD from New York University in 1956. His massive publication list is impressive, indeed intimidating. He has authored over 70 books and articles, making a contribution to the revenues of the forest industry, for which we in British Columbia are deeply grateful. Professor Singer is one of the world's acknowledged authorities on the causes of war, arms control, disarmament, and the application of social science to the study of foreign policy. Tonight he will speak to us on the topic international security in the 1980s. Professor David Singer.
Thank you, Professor Cairns, for the not only gracious but mercifully brief introduction. It's always nice to know that in some indirect, elliptical way, something we do in the United States is helping rather than hurting the British Columbia economy. And as a matter of fact, I will now go back to Ann Arbor and encourage my colleagues to double their efforts to publish before Vancouver perishes. It's a delight to be in Vancouver. This is my very first visit. I have, of course, a good many close colleagues and friends in the Department of Political Science. I've had a very delightful week here already, meeting a large number of the faculty, grad students, and undergrads. Let me, at this time, apologize to that small number of people in the audience who did hear my Thursday talk. There will be a modicum of overlap in the emphasis and on the material. In the introduction, Professor Cairns pointed out, and I'm pleased to note this, that I have worked very hard to bring the concepts and the methods and the findings of the social sciences to bear on problems of international politics in general and international conflict in particular. I would like to be able to say that most of my observations tonight will be found to rest on really solid social science evidence and real solid social science knowledge. Unfortunately, that cannot be claimed. I would go so far as to say not only do we know in any really confident way very much about the basic dynamics of international politics, but that very ignorance is itself a major ingredient explaining the pretty pass to which we have recently come. To put it another way, nations move into serious disputes and into military conflict not only because of the factors that I intend to discuss here tonight, but also because of the incompetence of the decision makers, the incompetence of the politicians, the incompetence of the political elites and the counter-elites, and the incompetence, of course, of the journalists, and finally, of the attentive and voting public. Now, by incompetence, one does not mean to suggest stupidity or laziness or slothfulness or graft or corruption. One only means to suggest, using this phrase, a dramatic and dangerous absence of knowledge, an absence of a knowledge base from which you might be able to say with some confidence, if our government does this under these conditions, this is the most likely set of outcomes, and this is the least likely set of outcomes, and so on. Essentially, we would like, in the social sciences, to be able to do what is done with somewhat greater success in the biological and the physical sciences. As you know, in some of the social sciences, we're more advanced, we're further along. And those of you who heard Larry Klein last week may even have come away with the notion that economists know what they're talking about. And, of course, that reminds me that one of the other problems is that even if we as scholars, researchers, teachers, and policy pundits, even if we did know better what we're talking about, there is always the problem of getting that knowledge into the policy process. And that requires, in turn, not only a political climate that makes certain kinds of analyses and predictions and forecasts more palatable to the decision makers, but it also requires decision makers who know how to evaluate the evidence and to interpret rival interpretations and to compare and choose among our rival predictions and forecasts. I mention this because in the economic realm in North America, the economists are not doing very well in terms of understanding the dynamics of the problem, but as I'm sure most of you have observed by now, they're doing even less well when it comes to making their recommendations felt in these circles of power. And many people who criticize the sort of research we do, what we normally call peace research, many of our critics say, well, all of the work you're doing is intellectually very interesting, and sometimes it's even aesthetically delightful, and we enjoy looking at your charts and your graphs and your correlation coefficients. But what makes you think that you will ever get policymakers or their critics to pay any attention to your findings and bring that knowledge to bear on the policy process? It would seem to me that at the moment one cannot be particularly optimistic, either about the rate at which we're making the relevant discoveries or the rate at which those discoveries will be brought to bear. One important ingredient in this affair, of course, is that we make university education much more concerned with helping students to come out of the university with the intellectual autonomy that can permit, in turn, a modicum of moral autonomy. But if we continue the trend, as we're finding these days in North American higher education, more and more we are treating the university not as the four-year period in a youngster's life devoted to the expansion of horizons and the sharpening and refinement of the conceptual repertoire and the enhancement of intellectual tools, but rather we are becoming, as Senator Fulbright told the Americans many decades ago, we're moving into a situation in which the universities are becoming service stations for American industry. And as long as the University of British Columbia or any other university puts as heavy an emphasis as it seems to on preparing people for professional school, preparing people for their jobs, we are going to shortchange that part of education that is absolutely essential to the functioning of a democratic society. Now, this is a roundabout way of my coming to my subject matter, but I want to emphasize that the problem that I'll be outlining tonight is not one that is separated from the educational process. It's not one that can be divorced from the incompetence of the journalists or the laziness of the media people, or, I might add, the extent to which the entire social system is heavily dominated, heavily influenced by short-term economic and commercial considerations. Now, what I'd like to do, bearing in mind these, if you will, these epistemological and political assumptions I've outlined, I'd like to cover three general points this evening. The first, what I'd like to do... is to describe the contemporary state of strategic affairs. I will not try, in the limited time available, to do a tour de horizon. I will not deal, for example, with the problem of third world security, limited wars, the Soviet-American rivalries in the Middle East, Africa, Central America, and what have you. I will concentrate very heavily on the strategic military relationship between the United States and the USSR. Naturally, I will also have to concentrate on the political. My second point will deal with some hypotheses and some observations as to how we came to this pretty pass. And my third point will be an effort to spell out some possible prudent, safe exits from what I consider to be an extremely dangerous state of affairs. I consider it a very dangerous state of affairs, much more dangerous than at any time since World War II, for a number of reasons. The first, of course, is just the sheer number and destructive power of the nuclear weapons, and to a lesser extent, the conventional weapons, available to the superpowers and to the NATO and Warsaw Pact alliances. Another reason I consider the situation extremely dangerous is that both the Soviet Union and the United States have moved inexorably during the last 3.5 decades into a condition that might best be called a garrison state. Now, it's more visible in the Soviet Union, because typically when we think of a garrison state, we also think of one in which you have a high concentration of political authority and in which you have a relatively low range for the expression and organization of political opposition and political deviation. But the United States, to a considerable extent, is also, in some manner of speaking, looking more and more like a garrison state. A society that is spending more than 50% of its annual federal budget on military preparedness. And parenthetically, you will hardly ever hear me talk about defense spending. It is many, many years since the United States or the Soviet Union has put money into defense. They have put money into the military, and I want to suggest tonight that defense has indeed been jeopardized, national security has indeed suffered because of excessive military outlay. We are in trouble because this trend, the increasing strength of the military-industrial complex, or what one of my colleagues referred to today as the increasing appearance of a state within a state, a political, industrial, military, academic, intelligence, diplomatic subculture that to a large extent controls the society, dominates the decisions as to how resources are allocated, and is increasingly impervious to political manipulation and pressure from the other sectors and strata of their societies. As a matter of fact, some months ago, Roy Medvedev, a Russian intellectual who has on occasion been able to express his views in the Western media, wrote a very interesting essay on the Soviet economy. And what he said was, there are four economies in the Soviet Union. First, there is the military economy. They get everything they want. Next, there's the heavy industry economy. They get pretty much what they want, but they have to battle for it. Then there's the light and consumer industry economy. They get almost nothing. And then there's the agricultural economy, and they get wheat from the Canadians and prayers for good weather from the priests. And I thought in his somewhat humorous way, he was indicating the extent to which the military-industrial complex has established a stranglehold on the Soviet society to an extent that may even exceed that of what has gone on in the United States. A fourth reason for the situation today being quite dangerous is that we not only have this bureaucratic and political momentum and inertia, but the technological momentum and inertia. In Science magazine some 6 months ago, there was an excellent series of articles dealing with what's called technological creep in the military hardware sector. And the point of the author, an extremely competent woman who wrote a series of three articles, the point was that inexorably, week by week and month by month, small, incremental, but cumulative changes occur in weapons technology, creating all kinds of cumulative new opportunities. And if I can digress for a minute, people are always fond of pointing out in North America and Western Europe, well, look, the Americans have not installed a new family of missiles, or they have not deployed a new family of manned bombers in 15 years or 22 years or whatever the figure is. And therefore, the viewers with alarm say, the Soviets, of course, have installed a whole series of new families of weapon systems. And this, of course, is a real red herring. The Americans have not had to build brand new families of weapon systems because every single weapon system is being improved and improved in quotes, but modified and made more advanced month by month and year by year. If we were still using the old World War II system for classifying weapons as we did in the United States, we used to talk about Mark 1 and then Mod 1, Mod 2, Mod 3, Mod 4. So that when we talk about the alleged obsolescence of the B-52 manned bomber, this is absolutely absurd. This is an aircraft that has gone through so many mods in the last 2.5 decades that it is only similar in its external appearance. The airframe has not been changed much, but almost everything else has been steadily upgraded. Why else would we have this extraordinarily high military budget? Well, we are spending a great deal of money updating these weapon systems, and I will say later more of the same regarding the missile delivery vehicles in the submarines and in the land-based systems. Then there's the psychological momentum and inertia, perhaps the most terrifying of all. The extent to which the human race has come to believe either, and sometimes both, that nuclear war is inevitable and there's nothing we can do to head it off, or nuclear war is so horrible that these people, who after all know their jobs and after all don't want to blow the world up, will somehow or other successfully muddle through. I think both of these assumptions are extremely ill-founded. Nuclear war is not yet inevitable, in my judgment, although my own research findings suggest some rather alarming parallels with that 75% of the serious disputes involving major powers since the Napoleonic Wars that did end up in war. For those of you who've paid some attention to our Correlates of War project, you may know that we are looking at over 1,000 serious disputes involving sovereign states since the Napoleonic Wars, and we're looking particularly closely at the 300 and some odd involving major powers on each side. Only 13% of those disputes ended up in war. But if you had the conditions historically that we have today, or that we're close to having today, three-quarters of that population of serious major power disputes historically did end up in war. The psychological denial, the drift, the fatalism, the acquiescence, the self-deception has, I think, made this situation today extremely precarious. Now, in my judgment, however, the most serious factor in describing today's state of affairs that should give us pause for real alarm is that these background conditions that I've been describing have permitted the political elites and counter-elites throughout most of the Northern Hemisphere to acquiesce, if not applaud, in a gradual shift away from what used to be called massive retaliation or mutual assured destruction as a basis for the major powers' national security policies. Now, some of you have been hearing increasingly such phrases as counterforce strategies, silo-busting capabilities, the need for a flexible response, the ability to prevail in nuclear war, and even occasionally in moments of absolute irresponsibility, the concept of being able to win a nuclear war. Now, the tragic thing is that a combination of political, technological, and psychological processes has led us so that during the last 6 or 7 years, first the Americans and secondly the Soviets. The Soviets are usually a few years, 3, 4, 5 years behind the Americans, not only in each of the major technological innovations, but in each of the major shifts in strategic doctrine, which in the case of nuclear missile warfare means in the targeting doctrine. Today, both the Soviets and the Americans have shifted discernibly away from the idea that all you need to deter the adversary is a sufficiently large and invulnerable retaliatory force so that no matter what kind of first strike is launched by the adversary, your side will have a sufficient number of nuclear missiles left over, surviving, so that you can then inflict unacceptable damage on the adversary. Now, I never want to suggest that that is a rational, prudent, or humane basis for protecting Russians from American imperialism or Americans from Russian imperialism. But I want to suggest that as stupid and dangerous and costly as the doctrine of mutual assured destruction was, what we are drifting into today is 2 or 3 times more costly and dangerous. As I've already intimated, the assumption here is that you have not only got to be able to ride out an enemy first strike, you've got to be able to threaten to go first. Now, very often, particularly on the Western side, the statement is made, we are not seeking a first strike capability. We have no intention of going first, but we do want to have a counterforce capability so that if, God forbid, nuclear war, quote, breaks out as if it were something like a rainstorm or a mudslide, if nuclear war breaks out, we want to be in a position to limit it, to control it, and to win it. And that means we've got to be able to destroy whatever missile silos the Soviets have remaining after they have launched their partial first strike against North America. Well, this is one of these clever arguments that utterly ignores the fact that you need precisely the same kind of capability to limit damage, to ride out, to prevail, and to win in a nuclear war as you need to initiate a nuclear war. And the American people have not yet come to grips with this, nor have the people who live in the countries that are allied with the United States. It seems to me an absolutely essential recognition that as we move away from the mutual assured destruction, we are creating a state of affairs in which both sides have an increasing potential to strike first. Each side has an increasing incentive to strike first because each side is afraid that the other's incentive to strike first is increasing. And if I can add one more complication to this already complex and terrifying state of affairs, it is the renewed interest in what's called civil defense. Fallout shelters, blast shelters, evacuation plans, crisis relocation programs, and so forth. The idea, of course, is that if you get into a crisis, it would be highly desirable to evacuate your cities so that if the adversary strikes your cities, he will not find anybody at home. Now, there are two things wrong with this crazy idea, assuming, for example, that you could get your people out of cities in sufficient time. One of the things that's wrong with it is that it will not save very many lives. It will merely prolong the death throes of those who manage to be somewhat further away from the major targets. Secondly, and even more serious, crisis relocation could be exactly the move that could convert the knife-edge stability of a political crisis into a nuclear holocaust. Because if we and the Soviets are at the brink of war, as we were, let's say, during the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962 or the Middle East Crisis of 1973, when both sides went all the way up to the next to highest strategic alert, if the Russians or the Americans start moving their people out of the cities, you can just see what that does to the argument on the other side that says we'd better go first because they're fixing to. Happily, the one dangerous thing that has not been done yet is that neither side has gone ahead with any serious effort to build an anti-ballistic missile system. And I take some pride in the fact that I played a very active role in the 1960s, in the middle and late 60s, helping to lay out the strategic and psychological and political reasoning why an anti-ballistic missile system would be not only not an advantage to the United States, but would be a serious disadvantage, a dangerous and costly liability. And the argument, as I think you can anticipate, is that an anti-ballistic missile system, whether it's based on old-fashioned short-range ground-to-air missiles that are supposed to be designed to hit an incoming ballistic missile, somebody once characterized this as having as high a probability of making this hit as two people standing at ends of a 20-meter corridor throwing a needle at one another and hoping that the needles will meet. It's an extremely difficult job. The technology of interception is quickly overcome by the technology of evasion, and it goes on and on. Or more recently, we've heard talk again about laser types of anti-ballistic missile defenses. The point, of course, is that if you have any kind of ABM system, it would be relatively ineffectual if the other guy goes first. But if you go first and you wipe out, as we now can, two-thirds or three-quarters of the Soviet land-based system, or if the Soviets go first and they, as they can, wipe out two-thirds or three-quarters of the North American land-based missile system, that means that the resulting retaliatory strike is much smaller, it's more scattered, it's less well coordinated. The command and control systems have probably been very badly damaged, and even a moderately effective anti-ballistic missile system could make a difference. If we go to civil defense and if we go to what's called active defense, we are, in my judgment, further increasing the likelihood of nuclear World War III. Now, a quick set of comments as to how we got ourselves into this pretty pass. I've already given you some indication of what I consider to be some of the major dynamics. But a couple of other points I think are quite essential. There used to be a very interesting debate among students of international politics regarding what is called the armament tension dilemma. The question, of course, is if we want to get out of a dangerous arms race, one that's dangerous not only in terms of the physical survival of a nation, or in this case of a globe, but one that is menacing and dangerous in the economic way, in the sense of what it does to the social fabric, in the sense of what it does to the attitudes that people have toward one another, both within and between societies. Should we try to disarm or reduce armaments first, or must we first reduce the tensions? And the classical conventional argument was that, look, nations only arm in response to some real or imagined external threat. There is political rivalry and political conflict between nations, goes this argument. That leads to tension between the nations, and that in turn leads to the acquisition of armaments. Well, that's one of these charmingly simple arguments that just does not stand the empirical test. First of all, there is no sovereign state on the face of the globe, with the exception, I think, of Costa Rica, that does not have some kind of standing military force. As a prime minister of a newly independent state said at one of those early conferences in the late 50s, at a conference on Malta of the newly independent political parties, should we consider not having an army, a navy, and an air force? And after several hours of debate, very spirited debate on this issue, one of the delegates got up and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, you don't understand. A nation, a sovereign nation, without an armed force is like a gentleman without a necktie." And the point being that it's a symbol of statehood. Armies, navies, and air forces are the crown jewels of sovereignty. Now, that's the first point. The second point is that every dollar you spend in military preparedness gives some degree of economic power to those elements on whom it was spent. Every billion that you spend, particularly if it's been going on for 35 years, solidifies and expands the economic and political power of those on whom it is spent. The point being that you may start to increase armaments above the crown jewel level in response to some external threat, but within a couple of years, you are no longer responding exclusively to the magnitude of that particular threat. You're increasingly responding to what I described earlier, the tremendous amount of domestic momentum in which the rich get richer, the poor get poorer, and the world becomes more and more dangerous every day. I'll spare you for the moment any long digression on the ways in which military spending turn out to have a rather dramatic inflationary effect. I think for Canadians, I need merely point out that if military spending is inflationary, and if inflation continues to rise in the United States, the likelihood is that interest rates will rise as well. The likelihood of that is that building starts will remain low, and the likely consequence of that is that unless we publish a lot of books, you're not going to be selling a lot of timber to the United States. So my point then is that we do not get into arms races as a result merely of hard-nosed, prudent, pragmatic analysis about some realistic state of affairs. You need the external threat to kick off the process And you need the external threat, again, real or imagined, to give the process a little bit of an acceleration from time to time. But what we have today, and as we have in almost all arms races of the last century, you have a lethal combination of very strong domestic incentives reinforced and legitimized by certain kinds of external threats and needs. Now, I'd like to devote my remaining time to the possibility of breaking out of this very, very dangerous state of affairs. As I've already indicated, most of the human race feels that either we don't need to worry. As a matter of fact, I should have indicated that when we won the anti-ballistic missile fight in the 60s, we won it because we had put together what I can only call an unholy coalition. Not only some defense analysts like myself, then there were those who didn't want to waste the money, then there were those who didn't want these installations in their backyards, and then there were those very, very charming characters who said, oh, nuclear war is so dangerous, it's so unthinkable, it will never happen, and therefore we don't need to have any ballistic missile defense system. My own view is that that indeed is a very ostrich-like position. So as I suggested earlier, some people think it can't happen, others think it's inevitable, and either one of these assumptions, of course, leads to passivity and acquiescence. A number of us, however, have been working hard for 1 year, 10 years. In my own case, I've been in the peace movement in the United States since a week after I left the Navy at the end of World War II. I even stayed in it during the Korean War, which is one reason that I had a great deal of trouble with my commanding officers at one time or another, who kept reminding me, a singer, a commissioned officer on active duty must not be politically active. And I said, you show me that in the Constitution, Captain, and I'll stop being politically active. And you know, we now have a couple of interesting new cases in which American GIs in Europe have gone to political demonstrations in uniform. And I think it's going to become an increasingly common phenomenon, and the American forces in Europe are going to have themselves a difficult and embarrassing problem on their hands. Many of us have given a great deal of thought not only to the question, how do we get into these miserable, dangerous, and costly arms races, but how might we get out? The number of interpretations as to how we get into arms races, fairly numerous. The number of suggestions as to how we might get out is voluminous. As a matter of fact, in Oslo, every 2 months, there is a journal called the Bulletin of Peace Proposals, published by Marek Tay. In a journal like the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, month after month, you see all kinds of ideas and proposals. Thus, mine is, some would say, a hodgepodge of many other people's ideas, and I'd say basically it's an eclectic approach that rests on the assumptions that I've already articulated. The first step, it seems to me, is for the United States to accept a proposal that the Soviet Union has made quite frequently, and in my judgment, quite genuinely on many occasions. The proposal is that the Soviets and the Americans sign a joint declaration announcing that under no circumstances will either be the first to use a nuclear weapon. Now, this may sound at first blush very, very simple-minded. After all, it's just a piece of paper. Well, first of all, I should remind you that pieces of paper, that is, international agreements, have a remarkably good track record. The trouble is that journalists and military and diplomatic historians spend too much time telling us about the treaties and agreements that were violated rather than the treaties that were adhered to. And there's nothing that Americans love to tell you more. Don't forget, comrade, what Lenin said. Treaties are like pie crust. They're meant to be broken. And I think he used the word treaties and other promises. Such a declaration by itself, of course, would have a brief but important psychological impact. But that by itself wouldn't carry us very far unless certain very important behavior ensued. Now, the most logical, inexorable consequence of a declaration as well as a bona fide commitment not to use nuclear weapons first is that you then begin to phase out those nuclear weapons that are primarily first-use, first-strike weapons. And the classic example, of course, of the first-use, first-strike weapon is the MX, the allegedly mobile missile, which is now scheduled to be put into missile silos, which are very unmobile, in the North American continent. So here is a weapon which, if it's ever deployed, and my own prediction, probably the only good news I have for you tonight, I don't think the MX missile system will ever be deployed. One reason it won't be deployed is that not only is it terribly expensive and therefore terribly inflationary, but it's the worst of both worlds. It's a weapon that will have much higher accuracy than any other weapon system now being used for the delivery of nuclear warheads, and it will be the most vulnerable because it will be in fixed silos buried in the ground. And even the original plan of the Reagan administration was to reinforce and what they call harden these silos with additional reinforced steel concrete. That decision has now been postponed because of the cost. And the Air Force is just going to have to go along with the idea of these brand new lovely little toys going into the same old, only moderately hard silos that were originally used by Minuteman II. My own guess is that this would be one of the first decisions that could be made on the American side. We will not go ahead with MX. The second is we will begin to close down the existing land-based systems because they, again, are highly vulnerable. You've all heard the expression, the window of vulnerability. In North America, we've been told that that window is opaque from the Russian side but transparent from our side, that we are the ones who have to worry. As a matter of fact, the Russians have to worry even more than the Americans, because not only do the Americans have a superiority of roughly 9,000 to 7,000 in deliverable strategic nuclear warheads, but the Americans only have about 30% of their strategic force in land-based silos, with the remaining 70 or so percent in the submarines, which at least for the moment are extremely invulnerable, and in the B-52 bomber force, which is extremely invulnerable, and in the aircraft carrier planes of the 2nd, 1st, 6th, and 7th American fleets. The Soviets have about 70% of their strategic deliverable warheads in land-based missiles. So the window of vulnerability is a very, very serious one for both sides. And the most sensible way of closing that window is to remove those attractive targets. If the Soviets and the Americans then agreed to a freeze on the production of additional ICBMs and a freeze on the production of strategic nuclear warheads, following on the heels of the joint declaration, and then went on to this phasing out, the processes about which I spoke earlier that led us up to the present state of affairs would begin to slow down, reverse, and accelerate, because you will begin to move money and people out of strategic military preparedness. And if we develop in the United States, in the Soviet Union, and elsewhere, an intelligent set of economic conversion plans now, I think we can do this with a minimum of economic dislocation. But even more important than economic conversion, as I've already intimated, is the notion of what I call socio-political conversion. If, as I've already suggested, we live in something that approximates a garrison state, we've got to begin working on the process of dismantling that garrison state. We have got to remove from the levers of power We've got to remove from the jugular of American society the hands of the military-industrial complex. These people are stifling and destroying our society, and these people, if they are permitted to continue, will blow up the universe, or blow up that part of the universe in which we try to inhabit. So I'm talking about a set of processes that could be initiated and triggered by these kinds of initiatives. When and if such initiatives were taken, the socio-political conversion as well as the economic conversion could get underway. People, for example, would begin to think, gee, maybe we've got a chance. Maybe nuclear war is not inevitable. People will begin to say, maybe we don't need to build fallout shelters. Maybe we don't need to accept crisis relocation programs. As a matter of fact, that is already happening. Some of you may already have heard about the marvelous experience in Cambridge, Massachusetts, in which the state civil defense authorities, the provincial, told the city council to distribute this pamphlet that tells people what to do in case of a nuclear crisis or a nuclear war. A couple of members of the Cambridge City Council read this pamphlet and said, these guys are nuts. We're not going to save any lives. And furthermore, as Singer and many others have suggested, this could even trigger nuclear war. They then not only refused to distribute it, they refused to spend any city money on it, and they took a couple of $1,000 and commissioned a new study that essentially says, here's what would happen if the following kinds of nuclear attacks occurred around the Cambridge-Boston area. Here's the kind of destruction that would ensue. And the only way to protect the people of the city of Cambridge from nuclear war is to make sure that nuclear war never occurs. Audience, to write to the city manager of Cambridge, Mass. For a copy of their civil defense pamphlet and get the people in your community to say, hell no, we won't go. And this was the Vietnam expression in the United States, and we should use the same one that when they say, folks, it's time to clear out, the bombs will soon be falling. I'm going to tell them in advance, no, we're not going to do it, that you guys are getting paid not to help us live 6 days longer as we die from radiation poisoning. We are paying you people to make sure this doesn't happen. Now get to work. My view then is that beyond this, many other moves could be taken unilaterally or negotiated with the Soviets. That, it seems to me, is much less important. I mean, there are lots of moves that could be taken right early on. For example, we should go as quickly as possible to an agreement that says there will be not a single nuclear weapon tested ever again. And as you know, the major powers continue to test nuclear weapons underground and underwater. Another agreement that I think could be very easy, and this is very easily monitored, we've got the technology there, another agreement that could be easily monitored is a ban on the flight testing of all ICBMs. Again, very easily done. And if neither side could continue to test those ICBMs, and if neither side could continue safely and legally to test the nuclear weapons, there is a deterioration and a degradation process. And there is also a deterioration in each side's confidence that the bloody things will work. And the less confident they are that they'll work, the less tempted they're going to be to use them. And anything that we can do to accelerate that process and to make the scenario of initiating fighting and winning nuclear war less attractive, it seems to me, we want to be able to do. Let me close then by reiterating that we have come through a series of highly predictable and alarming series of decisions and non-decisions to a state in which we are on the very knife edge of nuclear war. Don't misunderstand, we are not living in a world in which the decision to go or no go with nuclear weapons will be made by a group of 4 or 5 very sane, rational, humane, pragmatic, experienced, brilliant, competent people. To a large extent, the decision has already been partially made. The weapons have been deployed. the command and control system by which they can be detonated has already been put in place. They will tell you in the United States that only the president can press the button. That has not been true in more than two decades. The ultimate decision as to when and where and how nuclear weapons will be employed is in the hands already of hundreds, perhaps thousands of people. More tragically, it's in the hands of the technology over which we no longer have any control. That is, we have early warning systems with an appreciably discernible error rate. Early warning systems that produce false alarms at the rate of several per month. We have command and control systems by which we tell them to go or no go, which have breakdowns that occur several times per week. If they tell you that computers never make a mistake, just show them the last argument you had over your bank balance. Or look at the last check you got from the restaurant cashier. Computers and the people who run them make lots of mistakes. Our destiny today is in the hands of the software and the hardware of the characters who designed and built and programmed this electronic equipment. What I'm saying is the decision is no longer in the hands of the alleged decision makers. It has gone out. We have a chance. We have a very slim chance of pulling through. We will not pull through unless everybody in the world becomes more rapidly well-informed, politically active, and hard-nosed, prudent, vigorous, articulate, and no longer willing to accept the sense of impotence that may yet destroy us all. Thank you very much.
Professor Singer will be pleased to answer questions, so I'll ask you, as is customary, to raise your hand, and I'll identify you as the questioner, and I'll ask our speaker to repeat the question so that everybody hears the question he's answering.
Possibly.
Yes. The question the gentleman puts is, what makes us think that we have such reliable information about what Soviet military capabilities are or are likely to become, because it's not that easy to penetrate Soviet society? Well, as a matter of fact, the journalists and the politicians love to speak about open and closed societies, and they love to tell us that the Soviet Union is a closed society, and that's, of course, a fantastic exaggeration. There is no such thing as a closed society under today's surveillance technology. The Soviets cannot move a truckload of coal without the Americans knowing, if they care to know. The Americans cannot move an ICBM out of the assembly shed and toward a silo without the Soviets knowing. The orbiting satellites are keeping a very close watch. I don't want to say that these are accurate. There's a lot of bum dope being generated by these surveillance systems, which is one of the reasons that I'm a little bit nervous. Then in the United States, there are, as all of you know, and in Canada, there are thousands of Soviet spies and agents. In the Soviet Union, there are thousands of Western spies and agents. It is an incredible, I don't know the number, and I don't know how we could estimate it. But people who specialize in the study of military and diplomatic intelligence and espionage would certainly put the number in the thousands, maybe 10,000 Western spies within the Soviet Union. So as a matter of fact, when American State Department gets very upset because the Soviets have deported some character for being a spy, the chances are he was a spy. Just as when the Russians get very upset when the Canadians and the Americans deport a fellow because he was a spy, the chances are he was a spy. There's a lot of spying going on. But you don't even need to either use gumshoe James Bond tactics or fancy modern technology surveillance. There are all kinds of open sources. There are all kinds of semi-open sources that give us all kinds of opportunities to figure things out. One general point I'd make in this regard, if we can make something and we've got it working, it's pretty safe that the other guy can make it and he'll have it working in 3, 4, 5 years. And that in itself is a very solid piece of inferential evidence on the basis of which we do this. But we know, the Russians know to the single number how many ICBMs the Americans have. The Russians already know that before the Reagan administration has left office, we will have added, we now have 25,000 tactical, theater, and strategic warheads in the American arsenal. The Reagan administration is planning to add 17,000 more warheads to the American arsenal in the next 2.5 years. Let them know you don't think it's a good idea.
Yes, Doctor. Like Dr. Klein asked last week, I think you presented us with a very technical answer to what seems to be a very, very tremendous problem. But I think any politician in the U.S. knows that outside of Ann Arbor, Michigan, or Boulder, Colorado, there is a tremendous antagonism against communism in the American public.
Even in Ann Arbor.
And I would think that that's probably also true in Russia, that there's tremendous antagonism against capitalism. And I was wondering if you could just maybe place this ideological difference in the context of the scenario. Thank you.
Yes, the question I think was clearly audible around the room. The question is the extent to which the great antipathy of the two societies' populations to the ideology and to the political regime of the other is not itself a major obstacle. And I think there's absolutely no question that you're quite correct. I would hasten to emphasize that this great antipathy toward what the Americans like to call communism is largely something that is generated by the steady drumbeat of propaganda that begins in the grammar schools, is reinforced in the Sunday schools and the Boy Scouts, the Rotary Club, the Kiwanis Club, the YMCA, and, of course, most seriously, right on up through secondary school and the universities. Matter of fact, we've got a lot of opinion survey data that shows that the higher the educational level in the United States, and Cal, correct me if this is not right, the higher the educational level of the respondent, the slower those people were to come around to opposing the American intervention in the Vietnam War. The corollary, Singer's corollary, of, let's say, Holstein's law, is that the more educated we are, the more gullible we are. The first people who turned against support of the American intervention in the Vietnam War were black automobile workers in Dearborn, Michigan. And the point is that the educational system in the Soviet Union and to a lesser extent in the United States has essentially been geared to rev up and maintain and feed simplistic, primitive, hostility-generating notions of what the other society looks like and is up to. Some of you may have heard my interview with Doug Collins the other night. Now, if Doug's in the audience, which is highly improbable, he won't mind if I say that a lot of people in Western Europe and a great many more people in the United States have a Doug Collins view of the Soviet Union. And this is a tragedy. Worse yet, a very large fraction, as you point out, of Russians have a similarly distorted, inaccurate, and dangerous view of the United States and its political leadership. It seems to me that one of our objectives is to become one-member truth squads. And when somebody says, well, you know these totalitarian societies, there is no such thing as a totalitarian society. That's a propaganda word that you use to describe the bad guys. There are some societies that are much more autocratic. There are some societies that are much more repressive, and nobody who knows anything about the Soviet Union would want to say anything very generous about the way in which political opponents and political dissidents are treated. And nobody wants to suggest that it is a classless society or that it's a society in which there's anything approximating social justice. You don't have to love those people to recognize that we and they are on this planet Earth together, and we have the opportunity to either survive in it together or to blow it up together. Now, I'm glad this came up. The question is, given the fact that the Reagan administration has such people as Rostow, Pipes, Eclay, Tanter, I could go on right down the list, people who have made a reputation, made a career out of being professional anti-Bolsheviks, is there any chance that we make progress on any front, including, of course, something like the theater nuclear weapons issue in Western Europe or a revival of the SALT II strategic arms agreement? I have to admit that when I run down this list of people who have been brought in, and if you think they're bad, you should see the people who they didn't quite take. And I'm always pleased when I remember that they found Bill Van Cleave a little too simple-minded, a little too hawkish for their taste. But in any event, there's no question that this administration in the United States is heavily dominated by people whom I would have to call diplomatic and political primitives. I call them primitives, and they call me a capitulationist. You remember the book by Drury, Alan Drury, Advise and Consent? This was one of the first what I would call invidious right-wing political novels. The villain in the book is a certain senator who looks a lot like George McGovern and who, at a critical moment in the denouement, is alleged to have said, I would crawl on my belly to Moscow to avoid nuclear holocaust. Well, I don't think any of us are talking about crawling on our bellies. We've been crawling on our bellies in Moscow and in Washington by the extent to which we've kowtowed to the kind of people whose names you've articulated. These people, the Reagan administration, let me say a few words about this, because it may be that you're getting a distorted view here across the border. The campaign was certainly a very ideologically charged one, and you got just an incredible barrage of statements that should be, I think for you our neighbors in the North, absolutely terrifying. Happily, if there are any small things for which we can be grateful, most of the ideologues did not get taken into the government. I subscribe to and receive, without paying, lots of right-wing mail as well as left-wing and progressive mail. And the right-wing people are furious. They are livid over the fact that they got all these pinkos in the Reagan administration. I suppose the question is, to what extent is it likely that national governments will regain political control from these states within states, from the military-industrial complexes? And I suppose, yes, to the extent that they are no longer in bed with one another. But the politicians are in bed with the military. The journalists are in bed with the military. As a matter of fact, one of the names you might have mentioned is Richard Burt. Some of you may even recognize the name, B-U-R-T. For 6 or so years, Burt was the alleged military analyst for the New York Times, usually 3 columns a week. Go back and read those columns, and you will find an incredible litany of what in the Navy we used to call bum dope. Just a tremendously high error rate, always in the same direction. Very sorry, comrade. An oversight on my part, because I'm the sort of guy who dashes off letters to these guys. I'm a one-man truth squad when I have the energy and I'm feeling optimistic. And they always write back, oh, sorry, I didn't mean to say nuclear weapons. I meant to say delivery vehicles. Oh, I didn't mean to say that the Soviets were ahead in Navy tonnage. They just happened to have a few more patrol boats. You know, these small details. Okay, we have arrived at such a pretty state. The Time, Newsweek, U.S. News, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Christian Science Monitor, and then these bloody television networks put out an incredibly consistent array of misleading, incomplete, dishonest information, not because they are dishonest. I mean, guys like Rich Burt are exceptions. I mean, these people, he is what he was drumming for that job. He did what his masters wanted for 6 or 7 years, and he was paid off. This is a kind of political payola. But, I mean, the Walter Cronkites of the world, they're not basically dishonest guys. Now, they make a lot of money. They've got a lot of prestige. They're elected the most popular fellow in the country. They nevertheless put out an incredible amount of bum dope because they're ill-informed. They are, to go back to my opening comments, epistemologically ignorant. And they are in business, the name of which is show business. And all they care about is maximizing their audience and maximizing the take. So it's not going to be easy to see the elected political representatives in the Soviet Union and the United States, and they do elect them in the Soviet Union, regain the legitimate political power from the military-industrial complex because, as I think Pogo said, we have seen the enemy and they is us. Very interesting problem. The extent to which progress in nuclear arms reduction would lead us to a state of affairs in which the Soviets would enjoy, at least in Europe, a marked conventional weapon superiority. I would say it's propaganda, but not to such an extent. That is, in strategic and tactical nuclear weapons, it is absolutely unambiguous that the United States is ahead in every bloody category. When it comes, whereas most Americans believe that it's the other way around. When it comes to conventional weapons, in the European theater, it seems to me that on balance, the Soviet bloc does enjoy a slight superiority. I think it's been grossly exaggerated. As a matter of fact, when people sit around speculating in my business about, well, what is, you know, what's the conventional war scenario in Central Europe likely to look like this year or 2 years down the road or 5 years down the road? There's a lot of speculation. I commend to you a book that's politically very naive, but I think tactically and strategically very sophisticated militarily. It's called World War III by a British retired general and a couple of his colleagues. It's called World War III. Hackett is the name of the first author. And I find it an extremely competent and extremely credible fictionalized scenario of what a conventional war in Central Europe would look like. My own view is that under present circumstances, given the fact that the Soviets and the Warsaw Pact forces enjoy a dramatic superiority in tanks, something slightly better than 2-1, that they could punch through in a surprise attack using tanks and tactical aircraft for 2, 3, 4 days. But the Western powers have a tremendous advantage in anti-tank technology, numbers, quality. And, of course, the Westerners do have a slight superiority in tactical conventional aircraft. I think somewhere around the third or fourth day, the Soviet lines of advance would be very, very exposed and vulnerable, highly vulnerable to what the military guys call interdiction. And I suspect that somewhere around the sixth or seventh day of a conventional war in Europe, the Soviet armored forces would be in full retreat. Now, I've talked to a lot of people who are responsible for the various fronts in Central Europe, and they range from highly optimistic to highly pessimistic, and it usually depends on where we are in the budget cycle. As a matter of fact, one of my colleagues has very interestingly discovered, Professor Ninchich at Michigan, he's discovered that not only do Soviet military expenditures rise and fall with the 5-year plan, American military expenditures rise and fall with the 4-year election cycle. And, of course, the annual, if you map the poor-mouthing propaganda that we find in the Western press, nobody's done this yet to my knowledge, but I'm almost certain that you would find that during the months just before, the weeks just before and during, military budget appropriation hearings, more Soviet submarines are sighted in the Gulf of Mexico. The Soviets have more breakthroughs in weapons technology, and the Soviets have this, that, or the other impending superiority. I do not want to belittle the problem of conventional parity in Central Europe. As a matter of fact, one of my proposals has been that the United States reduce strategic military spending by 20% beginning this year and increase conventional weapons spending by 5% and do that for something like 3 years in a row. The problem for conventional capabilities in Central Europe is less a matter of numbers of weapons or numbers of troops than it is standardization of equipment, standardization of component parts, and better coordination, command, and control. NATO is in some ways a joke militarily because it is so far from the kind of coordinated military organization that it could be. And we, at dinner tonight, we were discussing the question of the M-15 tank and the extent to which the Americans insist on having their own tank, the Germans theirs, the Anglo-British one theirs, and so forth. And this is true all the way down to small arms. I spent, not only did I spend World War II in the peaceful, pleasant reaches of the Atlantic Ocean, but I was fortunate enough to spend the Korean War in an even more peaceful reaches of the Mediterranean Sea. And one of my jobs on the flagship of the Sixth Fleet was to work with the officers of the other NATO vessels. And the situation was a mess. I understand that it is just as much a mess today as it was in 1951. So I think your concern is legitimate, but I think it has generally been exaggerated, and I think the problem is reparable. Let me hasten to add, since you've raised this question, one of the most important decisions facing, I'd say, the United States, the free world, and probably the whole world, is this question of theater nuclear weapons. I just think it would be an act of depravity to go ahead in accordance with the November 1979 NATO agreement to install cruise missiles and Pershing II land-based missiles in Germany, Belgium, Netherlands, England, or where have you. These are weapons that are virtually useless for going second. The Russians can take these weapons out without firing a single nuclear weapon. Virtually all of these weapons are vulnerable to conventional aircraft strafing and bombing attacks, highly vulnerable to sabotage. They can be used for one thing only, and that's for going first. And if anybody thinks we are going to make our West European friends feel more secure by putting first-strike nuclear weapons in their front yard, I don't know where the hell they got this crazy idea.
Yes.
Very nice question. Whose initiative was it to put these weapons into Central Europe? And I will tell you that nobody I know is able to answer your question, because the standard interpretation in my circles is that the Americans wanted to do it, and they seduced Chancellor Schmidt into making the speech in which he said, you know, we Europeans are in a highly vulnerable position today, and will become more vulnerable as the Soviets increase the deployment of the SS-20, which is their medium-range theater ballistic missile system. And, of course, the West Europeans in general, and the Germans in particular, do have a very, very tough problem on their hands. It seems to me the solution to their problem is to get cracking on two major fronts. The first is to beef up their conventional capabilities so there'll be no Soviet temptation of the Soviet Union. And let me say parenthetically, I consider the temptation at this juncture already to be very, very low, but not maybe low enough. And I consider the Soviet superiority in conventional weapons, which I've indicated exists but is not dramatic, not to give the Soviets that much blackmail leverage over Western Europe. What makes one nervous today about the West European picture is that you've got this massive outpouring of anti-nuclear sentiment, which could encourage the Soviets into believing that they can get leverage out of the theater nuclear capability and the conventional superiority and begin to make the kind of outrageous demands on the West European nations for concessions on this, that, or the other thing. And this is, of course, the scenario. I reiterate, I think it's a highly improbable scenario, but it's not impossible. The Soviet Union is run by people who are just as incompetent as the people who run the American military and foreign policy establishment. As a result, there is this danger, and my response then is that the Europeans should be pressing the Americans and the Soviets for a freeze on the production of nuclear weapons and for a no-first-use declaration and for a phasing out of all land-based systems. This is what I would like to see the campaign for nuclear disarmament in England, the Green Movement in Germany, and the various other pro-disarmament and anti-nuclear groups in Western Europe to push. As usual, we've got the serious problem that most of the political radicals in Western Europe have this touching faith in the goodwill of the Soviets and the imperialistic intentions of the United States. And my explanation of this is that it is psychologically easier to believe that the guy who is closer to you and most threatening is really more benign as a form of denial.
I think two more questions will have to suffice.
Dr. Singer, how much money does the Pentagon make available to the universities in the United States, or maybe some in Canada, for research having to do with military
I don't happen to know the number. The question is how much Pentagon money goes for military and war-related research in the American universities. But I'm sure most of you have heard that this is an increasingly hot topic on the campuses. And at the University of Michigan, there have been a series of official as well as unofficial studies and reports. And it should come as no surprise that it's hard to find out, because a lot of the research is what they call classified. And unless you have a need to know, you're not supposed to know who the money's going to and how big the grant is. There is no question in my mind that a great deal of what we call weapons-related research is going on in American universities. There's even a little bit, and it's interesting, a little bit of Pentagon money going to what I guess I would call peace-related tasks, very little, and my hope is that part of the economic conversion will be one in which this ratio gradually changes. So that, for example, we had at the University of Michigan from 1956 until 1969 the very first peace research center in the world. It was called the Center for Research on Conflict Resolution. And I took the job at Michigan because I wanted to be a part of that center. And when the financial recession of the late 60s hit us, and the political turmoil of the late 60s hit us, the university bureaucrats looked around for a really vulnerable target, and boy, this one was a sitting duck, and it was abolished. I would love to see it reestablished.
Oh, sir, right.
Yes, sir. Well, one last question to you. Suppose the United States and the Soviet Union do sign such an agreement, what are they going to do about France, about Libya, about China, about Afghanistan, and so on?
Fascinating problem. Suppose the Soviets and the Americans do agree to a no-first-use agreement and begin to not only say it but act on it. What do we do about France and England? Probably Libya and Israel, probably South Africa, probably Pakistan, probably India. Try to get them in on the bargain. I think it would not be too hard. But if we were not successful at the first, I don't think it would be a tragedy. Let me state that I think there's very little likelihood that the next 10 years will unfold without one or more nuclear weapons going off someplace in the world. I think this is very much in the cards. And there are going to be a lot of people killed. It may very well be, as some of the characters, the military analysts say, that we're going to need something like that, whether it's one of the underdeveloped states with its own small nuclear capability, or conceivably a so-called terrorist group. Incidentally, the largest terrorist groups in the world today are the air forces of the United States and the Soviet Union. Because after all, what is a terrorist but an individual or a group who says, if you guys don't do what we want you to do politically, we're going to blow your heads off. And I think it's very dangerous as well as dishonest to say that these fellows who are trying to get, let's say, more political rights for the Croats in Yugoslavia are terrorists, but the Russians who are trying to coerce or blackmail the Poles or the West Germans into this, that, the other thing, well, they're just engaging in realpolitik. The difference between them is merely the magnitude of the crime if it's committed. So I think we do have a problem with nuclear proliferation, and I might even add that in my judgment, one reason that nuclear proliferation, what we call lateral proliferation, has continued at the steady pace it has, is that there has been no freeze, no ceiling on the vertical proliferation of nuclear weapons on the part of the USSR and USA. As a matter of fact, I was quite active and I think even slightly instrumental in persuading the non-nuclear states to insist on Article 6 being included in the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Article 6 is the one that says, essentially, the non-nuclear states will remain non-nuclear to the extent that the nuclear states make progress on becoming also non-nuclear or post-nuclear. But the non-aligned states, as well as the allies of the Soviets and the allies of the Americans, have been remarkably passive in leaning on these superpowers to do anything to get the ball rolling. I would like to be able to say, when I come to Vancouver, that yes, the Canadian government has shown great imagination, courage, and initiative in pressing the Americans and the Soviets for a more prudent, humane, and sane strategic policy. I think to say so would be a gross exaggeration.
Professor Cal Holstie, a leading student of international relations and head of the Department of Political Science, will thank our speaker.
Well, David, we've heard a very articulate, persuasive, elegant statement of a particular point of view on international security and international insecurity. And judging by the applause after your talk and more recently, I think it's quite clear that you've made a very deep impression on many of us. I go home just a little bit puzzled, though. You began your comments suggesting that politicians, generals, admirals, reporters, television personalities are incompetent, and by that I accept your definition, being that they're basically not very well informed about the subjects in which they have to make decisions. I raised the question, why did you leave out academics? I'll just close by saying again, thank you. And judging on the basis of the response here, we will exempt you from the list of incompetence.